now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from classic cultural cheese between the movies your beef, the entertainment is grade A. And I am your host, Jason Jackanetti, joined again by my dad, Mr. Al Jackanetti.
Hey, Jay, how's it going? We've got another anniversary movie to do, just like we did the last time. You're dating me here now. It's 65 years, and the picture we're going to review is The Mummy from 1959.
Yeah, and we'll get to it right after this.
Egypt, 4,000 years ago, a land of strange rituals and savage cruelty. Many of their secrets are still hidden from the eyes of 20th century man. Secrets that protect their dead. Supernatural powers that once released can live again in our modern world. The Mummy, the Living Dead, bringing terror and death across 4,000 years. He was a high priest of the great god Karnak, until one night he attempted the ultimate in blasphemy. He was condemned to guard forever the princess he had loved and protect her from intruders.
Go and destroy those who desecrated the tomb of our princess. He who robs the graves of Egypt dies. He who robs the graves of Egypt dies.
The Mummy was released September 25th, 1959 in the UK with an 88-minute running time. Your director here is the one and only Terence Fisher. Yeah. It's his Hammer. Nothing says Hammer more than Terence Fisher, Christopher Lee, and Peter Cushing. And they're all here. And, of course, your screenplay by Jimmy Sangster, another name you all hear, and Michael Carreras. Like, this is prime wheelhouse Hammer.
Yeah, it's almost like it was their own group.
Well, yeah, that's what they did when they all worked together and they stayed together. But I'm saying, like, this is right in the wheelhouse of Horror Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, The Mummy. Like, these were the Hammer movies that everyone knows. And then they made all the sequels and stuff. And then Curse of the Werewolf came out. But, like, The Mummy, Horror Dracula, and Curse of Frankenstein. Boom, boom, boom. Heavy hitters. This is what we got. Right in your face kind of thing. Yeah. This is Hammer, you know. Of course, Peter, like I said, Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee are your big names here. Yvonne Frank, is it Frank?
Fourneau,
right? Yeah. Cinematographer was Jack Asher. Music by Franz Reitzenstein. And of course, this is Hammer Film Productions in association distributed by Rank Film Distributors in the UK and Universal International in the US with an approximate budget, and this is in pounds, of 100 to 125,000 pounds.
Okay, and the pound was 250 back then.
So, yeah, but this makes sense.
But you're not talking about, it's not even $1 million.
Yeah, but not 1959 Hammer. They didn't
know.
I didn't have that kind of money. They don't have a box office listed, but it did just over 850,000 admissions in France alone. So it did pretty well.
Yeah.
Now, in America, if you saw this in 1959, you probably saw it with one of two films, either Vincent Price's film, The Bat, you saw it with Universal's Curse of the Undead. Hope for the latter, hope for the former, not for the latter. Curse of the Undead is poor.
Yeah.
That's the head in the box and the whatever. You're like, oh, God. It's fine. But, you know,
again,
it's not quite The Mummy.
Yeah,
the Bat at least is decent.
Yeah, I mean, we would have seen it on a Saturday morning matinee with three other movies in 1959, including probably a Western.
Sure.
Maybe a monster film and a comedy, and then 40,000 cartoons.
And
a few coming attractions.
But I'm saying, but if anyone saw it as a first run, it was always double billed with that.
One thing I do remember about this movie is that it, and again, what I remember is not from when I was, you know, 13 years old, but when I've watched this thing a lot of times, the production values of the sets and what have you are first rate for a company that was not making hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, $1 million, you know, pitches.
Right.
So that's what elevates this movie, I think, quite a bit, is that when you watch it, you feel like you're watching something more than what the subject matter is.
So obviously, the title of The Mummy might have you thinking like, hey, is this a remake of 1932's film? And no, it is not. It actually is far closer to The Mummy's Hand and The Mummy's Tomb, right? And then borrows a little bit from like the whole ending of The Mummy's Ghost.
Those are the mid-40s.
Yeah, but I'm saying, so for those of you who think of The Mummy, remember, I've always said that The Mummy 1932 should be called The Egyptian. It should not be called The Mummy. It should be called The Egyptian, because 1932's The Mummy is much closer to Dracula than it is to than a mummy movie. Because he's the mummy for 5 seconds, basically, and I mean, whatever in the movie. But everyone remembers Karloff dressed as the mummy because it's so iconic looking, but he's not as the mummy. He's as the Egyptian, as, you know, kind of thing. So, but that's the difference between Imhotep and Kaharis, as we would see later on, kind of thing. So we have Kaharis here. All right, here we go. In Egypt, in 1895, archaeologist John Banning, his father Stephen, and his uncle John Wemple are searching for the tomb of Princess Anaka, the high priestess of Karnak. So, hang on. Some of you might know Karnak, you know, from your Johnny Carson days. Karnak. Right. I'm just saying Karnak is not an original Johnny Carson thing. It's a name that we had. Anyway, so John has broken his leg and cannot accompany his father and uncle when they open the tomb. Before they enter the tomb, an Egyptian named Mehet Bey warns them not to go in, lest they face the fatal curse of anyone against desecrators.
Right, and this is the classic thing. The warning is, he who robs the graves of Egypt dies.
Yep. Yeah, it's very straightforward.
Yeah.
So Stephen and Joseph ignore him, and they discover the sarcophagus of Anaka. After Joseph leaves to tell John the good news, Stephen finds the Scroll of Life and reads it, because nothing bad ever came from reading a book. Wait, that's the 1999 version. where they said, he literally says, whatever happened from reading a book. He goes, don't you remember? And that's the sequel. Outside, the members of the archaeology team hear his screams and they rush to the tomb to find Stephen in a catatonic state. 3 years later, back in England, Stephen Banning comes out of his catatonic state at the Elderfield Nursing Home for the Mentally Disordered and sends for his son. He tells him that he read from the Scroll of Life and he unintentionally brought back to life Kaharis, the mummified high priest of Karnak. The high priest had been sentenced to be entombed alive to serve as the guardian for Princess Inanna's tomb. Kaharis has secretly loved the princess and attempted to restore her to life after she died. When he was discovered, eternal life and mummification were his punishment. Now Stephen tells his disbelieving son that Kaharis will hunt down and kill all those who desecrated Inanna's tomb. Okay, so let's just stop there for a second. A lot of you are thinking, like, this sounds like a mummy movie I know. You should, because this is basically the setup of every mummy movie that's not 1932's The Mummy. It literally is almost, not exactly the same, but this is like Stephen Sommers' The Mummy as well. A lot of mummy movies have the exact same setup and lead-in. Why? Because it works. Now you're thinking, Jay, this doesn't sound anything like that mummy movie that the other a couple years ago with that chick in it. Yeah, I know. The Tom Cruise one, the less said, the better off we are, right? But I'm saying is, every mummy movie that we can kind of think of as being ones that were well-received, almost shot for shot is this beginning of this movie.
Right. Well, you almost have to, because there is no... You're not saying, geez, what is a mummy?
Yeah.
You know what a mummy is.
Right.
And if you want to bring back a mummy to life, well, that's the premise, is that there's got to be some reason.
So either you got to read the book of life, either you got to read the scrolls, you got to boil up some tanna leaves. You got to do something to get them up and running, right?
And it's definitely from the book of scrolls. Now, I mean,
the book of life.
Now, one of the things here is that, and I wrote it down, and then and it comes back later on, is that when they exhume all the artifacts from inside the tomb, they don't have the scroll. And I'm saying, how could you not have the scroll, but yet the Egyptian has got the scroll and he's reading from it to revive the mummy?
But we later learn how that happened.
But we later realize is that after they take John Banning out, he's hurt, the Egyptian runs in, gets the scroll and keeps it.
Yeah.
And so I said, good. They at least,
they explain it. Yeah. Well, there's parts I mean, he had to get Kaharis out of there too. I mean, that's the whole point. They had to get the mummy out of it because they didn't know about Kaharis.
Yeah, they didn't know about it.
He's mummified in the wall. He's in a secret chamber.
The thing is, there are no guards watching. Once they've taken everything out, there's no guards watching it. I mean, they're going to
blow it. Also could be a back door. We learned that in The Mummy's Ghost,
They're going to blow it up.
Or later. The Mummy's Tomb.
Yeah.
One of those mummy movies that are all back to the same thing. Yeah. We learned there might be a back door on the Hill of the Seven Jackals. So
the only thing is when they open up the tomb, it's the room is lit.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're willing to buy everything up to this point. We got to buy that there's lighting. And not everyone has those cool mirrors like they do in Stephen Sommers' The Mummy where they just shoot around the whole room, you know. So, all right. Meanwhile, Mehet Bey, a devoted worshiper of Karnak, comes to Enderfield under the alias of Mehet Atkil. Because I don't somehow they would know Mehet Bey was him. I don't know how he had to change his name. To wreak vengeance, on the Bannings, he hires a pair of drunken carters, Pat and Mike, to bring the slumbering Kaharis in a crate to his rented home. But the two men's drunken driving causes Kaharis' crate to fall off and sink into the bog. Later, using the Scroll of Life, Mehet exhumes. It's not exhumes, though.
Raises.
They wrote exhorts. It's what's written here. Exhorts. It should be exhumes Kaharis from the mud. Exhorts Kaharis to rise from the mud. They probably wrote it weird. Anyway, doesn't matter. He gets him out of the mud. That's basically what happens. And then sends him to murder Stephen Banning. So now Banning has come out of his catatonic state and they tell him he's still in the asylum. Like, you can bang on the door all you want. We're not going to hear you. If you need us, ring the bell. Very clearly tells him, if you need us, ring the bell. What does he do? Bangs on the walls, banging on the thing, going crazy because he sees the mummy.
Yeah.
Right? So.
No, he's in a, well, he's the mummy actually enters the room, not through the door, but through the window, which has got the bars and the.
He kicks the ball in.
Now, the thing is with this, now Banning is in a padded room.
Yep.
There is nothing in there that can hurt him except he's sleeping on a metal bed.
Yep.
Then if he wanted to hurt himself, the big balls on the ends of the posters.
Yeah.
All he has to do is just bend.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but again, they make it that he's in a padded room that is soundproof for a reason.
Right.
Because that's how the mummy can get in
right.
and get out
without being hurt. Yeah. Plot device. So he's killed, and then of course they're still trying to figure out what happens. And his son, you know, John believes that he was murdered, but he's just not sure how they murdered him. So when Kaharis then kills Joseph Wemple the next night, John witnesses he shoots Kaharis with a revolver at close range, but it has no effect. All right. Now I'm going to say this. Christopher Lee is wrapped up in the mummy wrappings. It is a stellar looking costume. Christopher Lee got burned when he got shot with a squib. The squib went off to make the thing happen, and it burned him for real. To which Christopher Lee was not very happy that he was burned for real with his face all bound up and everything in there. But Ever the Professional did not cut the scene and kept working through it with the burn he got from the shock, yeah. from getting shot.
Well, he shows that he recoils from the shot.
But he doesn't start losing his mind right. as people now, oh, I can't do it. Yeah. Like he said, oh, I'll just yeah, act through it.
Right. Yeah.
Just act through it. Be a professional. All, you know, give everything to Christopher Lee. And I for those people who maybe are not as well-versed in Christopher Lee, they only know him as like, in like from, oh, not even Sleepy Hollow. Most people don't even know he's in Sleepy Hollow. He's the judge. But like maybe as Willy Wonka's dad in like the Johnny Depp one, or maybe as Count Dooku in the later one, who don't know Christopher Lee. I mean, just one of the great actors.
Or is it, what's his name in Lord of the Rings?
Oh, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I'm saying. But like they only know old man, Christopher Lee. He was in a lot of movies for a lot of years and did serious, real movies kind of thing. Like not just, you know, not just genre stuff.
He's a big time actor.
And then a lot of people might not even know who Peter Cushing is outside of being Grand Moff Tarkin. But in all fairness, Peter Cushing did pass away, later kind of thing. He did pass away before, obviously, you know, a lot of people were even alive. But Peter Cushing was a very serious actor too.
Yeah.
And a avid hobbyist. He painted miniatures. Cool. There's videos out there of him painting his armies of miniatures. Yeah. I'm like, how cool is this? Right. And he's doing it very Britishly though. I don't mean that in a negative way. He's got a pipe.
Right.
He's got a smoking jacket on. It's not like me painting where it's just, well, I got paint everywhere. I'm like, no, there's glue sticking things together. It's all on like fine tables and fine. Everything's very nice. And anyway, but yeah. So those people who may not realize how deep these two go acting wise. You can see them in like things like The Three Musketeers and things like that. I mean, they're in like lots and lots and lots of movies.
Yeah. I mean, the series of movies that Cushing and Lee made were voluminous, but they were, I would say, money makers for, you know, for them. I mean, it was their paychecks. I mean, because when you think of Cushing, we know him with all the other ones, but every movie that Hammer was putting out, it was him and most of the time Christopher Lee. And if not Christopher Lee, it was Cushing all the way through. And then the anthology movie, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors.
That was Amicus.
Amicus.
That's Amicus now. They hired them on purpose.
Right. They're both in there.
Yeah.
But they...
Separate.
Cushing is the lead and Lee has his one episode.
So the whole thing, though, is that Peter Cushing allowed him, because he doesn't... Christopher Lee is taller, and he definitely comes across as being a very easy villain.
Oh, I just saw there was a movie from the late 40s. He's a man about town.
He's Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee.
Yeah. Oh no, he does. Well, he's in The Hound of the Baskervilles, where he's the lord of the Baskervilles.
Right, yeah.
Right. He doesn't always play the villain, but he's so good, and he's tall, and his look allows him to be a villain.
His looks were leading man time.
Yeah. But I'm saying, but he could definitely be like someone you could say he has that look. He could be sinister in what he's doing.
Yeah.
Christopher Lee in that way has that. Cushing, while he plays a bad guy, is always like the smart, the cunning, the whatever. No, I'm not saying that Lee was not, but Lee had the ability to be because he was taller and he was so sophisticated. You like, well, that guy's not a good guy.
Yeah. The only thing after this movie came out and then the others with Cushing and Lee in the horror brain, they became, categorized as that's what their movies are.
You mean, and, like Vincent Price? You mean like Boris Karloff? Who made a lot of money doing those things?
That's what I'm saying. And when you read the biography of Christopher Lee, that's why at one point he didn't want to do Dracula again.
No, that's
and
true.
And yet he was not being offered roles that could show his acting ability. And so, but again, it's one thing if somebody told me that if I acted in horror movies for 20 years, I could be a multimillionaire and live in a mansion. Okay.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, but it's a lot like Vincent Price. It's a lot like, Boris Karloff 100% got typecast away. I mean, but remember, the difference was Lugosi, because he was sick and then passed away, right, people didn't have as much relationship with Lugosi. Boris Karloff became everyone's grandpa kind of thing. Right. But he was the grandpa who was like, macabre and whatever, because he put his name on something. You're like, oh, Karloff, right, kind of thing. But Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing fell in that same category. But they also, they were in other things. Christopher Lee is Scaramanga in Man with the Golden Gun and whatever. And they play those roles really well. But it's really hard when you are Dracula. He's Dracula. He looks like Dracula. Like, how many movies make Dracula look at Christopher Lee?
Yeah.
Right? And then Peter Cushing, I know a lot of people will say, well, Peter Cushing is Baron Frankenstein or Dr. Frankenstein. He's so good at that because you believe when he's speaking, he sounds totally rational. I mean, he's saying things that are absolutely insane. He's like, look, I'm going to cut the brain out of this thing. And I put this brain in here. It's going to totally work. And you're like, I think it'll work. I think he's right. Kind of thing. Cause you buy it. But that's what a lot of movies that were made post Hammer kind of thing tried to use those, tried to reinvent those tropes with different people. It just didn't work all the time because as much as, I'm sure Kenneth Branagh really wanted to be Baron Frankenstein, I'm not buying him as Baron Frankenstein. And in all fairness, Bob De Niro is a pretty good actor, but I ain't buying him as the monster.
The monster, yep.
Compared to the one time that Christopher Lee played it. He played it one time, he played the monster. And him as the monster there is not even as iconic as Karloff or even Glenn Strange, right? Kind of thing. But that's the monster, right? Well, you say, but that's not what the book is, and that's not what Kenneth Branagh was trying to do. I go, right, which is why no one watches it. I mean, think about it. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Bram Stoker's Dracula. Two very different movies. Bram Stoker's Dracula, everyone remembers, everyone loves, they talk about whatever, even if it is painfully dull at times, right? But they remember because Gary Oldman took it over the top as Dracula. The wolf, the bat, the whole thing, the love story, everything in the movie, even Keanu Reeves, being supposed to be English, so no one buys, right? Kind of thing. You let it go. Because that movie was done in a way it's beautiful and everything else. And I'm not saying that shot-wise that Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley Frankenstein wasn't that, but I've seen it once. I'll never sit and watch it again.
Right.
Because why waste my time? And I'm not saying the actors weren't good because you have a lot of top-flight actors in that movie. And the costumes are good. They spent money on everything. Everything's good. But, who cares? Who cares? I'd much rather watch The Curse of Frankenstein, which is... Again, I understand supposed to be, the more vulgar kind of thing because it was like a B movie and what Ender's Killing. But that is interesting as heck. And any of the Frankenstein sequels, when you're watching them, like Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed,
right,
Frankenstein Created Woman, they're all really good. Even if they're kind of like, okay, what's he doing now? He's working in an insane asylum. He's going to sew together dead body parts of a gorilla. What is he doing? None of that matters because you're like, it's entertaining and you get through it. What people kind of forget though, and this is one that most people haven't seen. If you look back, Christopher Lee did a Jekyll and Hyde movie that was lost for years and is still kind of lost. He's so good at kind of just changing his face and doing small things, very much like Spencer Tracy in Dr. Mr. Hyde, but not like Frederick. Frederick Barge put a lot of makeup on him. I mean, there's makeup on him. And I'm not saying there's not makeup on Lee, but the movie is just so different from a take on Dr. Mr. Hyde. We hadn't seen that.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the name is.
And I'll find it. But the whole thing is that when you look at a movie like that, you're saying okay, that's great. That Christopher Lee, because he plays a doctor and, he's, It is called... No, that's not called that. That's Strange Case of Robin Hood. Why can't I find it? Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. That's the Hammer movie. This was... Why can't I find it? All right, I'll find it. It's not the Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll.
No.
In fact, he's in that. He's in it. He's in it, but he doesn't play the bad guy. He plays the friend, the other doctor.
It does not have any... If you see put the movie on and you have no idea what it is, there's no inkling that it's a Jekyll and Hyde movie. Whereas if you're watching any of the other ones, the untold story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you're gonna know that it's going to be a good guy and a bad guy.
Right. So anyway, let's get back to the story. Now I'll find that. So he shoots him. The police inspector Mulrooney is assigned to solve the murders, but because he's skeptical and deals only in cold, hard facts, he doesn't believe John's incredible story about a killer mummy, even when John tells him that he is likely to be Kahar's third victim. While Mulrooney is investigating, John notices that his wife, Isabella, bears an uncanny resemblance to Princess Anaka. Gathering testimonial evidence from others, individuals in the community, Mulrooney slowly begins to wonder if the mummy is real. Mehmet Bey sends the mummy to the Bang's house to slay his final victim. However, Isabella rushes to her husband's aid, where Kahar sees her and releases John and leaves. Mehmet Bey mistakenly believes that Kahar has completed his task and prepares to return to Egypt. John, suspecting Mehmet Bey of being the one controlling the mummy, pays him a visit, much to Bey's surprise. Now, that's the second time he breaks in. That's when he puts the fire poker into him. What a great scene. But that's also where he's choking him and he's leaning on the globe. It's just so many dynamics in the scene.
And that's the model.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah. I know it's the model, but I'm saying, but that's just so many dynamics in the scene. It's just hard to describe the way the scene's shot, the way he comes through the windows, like the way the doors, the way she enters the room, like it's really well done.
Yeah. So I'm saying that cinematography is what makes it. I mean, the thing with the poker through his chest.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know how it's done, mm-hmm. But again, like I said, from the very beginning, the production values on this movie are outstanding, and it elevates the movie, because when you go back over the, all it is a pretty basic story. Nothing, there's no blood.
No. I'm thinking there ain't blood at all in the whole, the thing is that you,
there's a lot of talking.
Yeah. Well, no, but yeah. Okay.
No, no.
But there's a lot of talking, a lot of movies, Dad.
But there's a lot of talking here too. And again, one of the things that you want is the explanation as to who this mummy is and why he's the mummy.
Right.
You know,
well, they do get to that.
You get to that. And that is a classic scene from the Karloff one.
Yes.
And the Karloff one is much more thrilling and exciting, and you're more sympathetic if you sympathize with the mummy than the scenes here. Because here, when he gets wrapped up and he gets his tongue cut out, that's fine.
The thing is, though, remember, the Karloff one was also stolen and used in the other sequels, where it's Kaharis, not Imhotep. So we're watching Imhotep's mummification for Kaharis to be used as the mummy in the movie, you know, kind of thing. So I'm just not seeing it. Why could I remember Eye Monster? It is great. If you've never seen Eye Monster, track it. It's hard to find. It's on a DVD. I don't think it's any Blu-ray of it, but it's...
No, I thought it was, when I ordered it, wasn't it one of those archive ones where they have to
print it? I think it is. That's what I'm saying. I think it's hard to get your hands on it. But I have it from years and years and years ago, like someone take it off of a VHS.
Yeah.
Like that's how I first saw it. And it's really good. Anyway, so where are we? So this is when John goes and sees Mehmet Bey at his house, right? Can there be any more awkward scene in this whole movie? Like, they're just back and forth, just taking shots at each other,
yeah.
You know, without taking shots, like, genuinely shots at each other. They're just, you know, instead of someone calling someone a poopy pants, and then it's about all that was missing from this scene. Like, well, I think you're a jerk, you know, kind of thing. But the scene does serve its purpose. It allows, you know, Mehmet Bey to know that he has not obviously killed, you know, kind of thing. So after John leaves, Mehmet Bey leads Gaharis in a second attempt on John's life. The mummy knocks out Mulrooney while Mehmet Bey deals with another policeman guarding the house. Gaharis finds John in the study and starts to choke him. Alerted by John's shouts, Isabel runs in the house without Mulrooney. At first, the mummy does not recognize her because her hair is not down. So she puts her hair down, and then the mummy's like, hey, I know her, right? When Mehmet orders Gaharis to kill Isabel, he refuses, and Mehmet tries to murder Isabel himself, but he is killed by the mummy being snapped in half. We see it off screen. He bends him over backwards, and you're like, oh no, he definitely broke his spine. Like, so you're hoping he died? Because otherwise he's just laying there paralyzed. Right? So, which is a lot darker probably than they were going for. They're just trying to get him off the screen. Okay, the mummy carries the unconscious Isabel into the swamp, followed by John, Mulrooney, and another policeman. John yells to Isabel. When she regains consciousness, she tells Gaharis to put her down. The mummy reluctantly obeys. When Isabel has moved away from him, the policemen open fire, causing Gaharis to sink into the quagmire, taking the scroll of life with him. So, the end of this movie is literally the other Roma movies, right, kind of thing. But I think that's what makes this movie so kind of... I love this one. This is my favorite mummy movie of like the, and now you're going to say, but Jay, what about the Stephen Sommers movies? Those movies are really good, but those movies are like Indiana Jones movies.
Right.
Those movies aren't mummy. Mummy movies.
They're true adventure movies.
They're adventure movies.
Yeah.
But this is a mummy movie. This is my favorite mummy movie because it takes my other favorites, which is Ghost, Hand. It takes them all and puts their greatest hits in one movie. And you're thinking, Jay, that sounds like those other movies because the other mummy movies had one movie. And then they kept the mummy's hand and they kept using all the same scenes from it. So the movies got shorter and shorter, you know, down to like a 56 minute running time with 37 minutes of old footage. So what did they film? Nothing much. But this is what a mummy to me is. When you put a mummy movie out there, I need to see some Egyptian guy. He's leading them back. He's chasing love across the century. Sounds like Anton Fives kind of ho too, huh?
Yeah.
Right. But that's the thing is, that's what you want in a mummy movie. It does that, yes. Is it very talky? Yes. Is it very British? Yes. But I think that's why I like it too. Because it's not adventure. It's not, you know, there's no shootouts. There's no nothing. This is just an old-time kind of classic movie.
Well, that's why Cushing is, when he's in a movie, it's almost like you've got a true professional. And regardless of what the words he's got to say or the plot, he's there. And the one thing about Cushing is that his visage, everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the most sucked in cheekbones of any. When you see him in Star Wars.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, he looks like he's almost emaciated.
Yeah.
You know, like he's coming out of his skin. His bones are.
Yeah, his bones are sticking out.
The end of the movie is, I've got two things that I need to say, but at the end of the movie, why does Gaharis have the scroll? How does he get the scroll? The scroll was not.
Oh no. Okay. So he had this. So Mehmet Bey had it with him.
Right.
When he kills him, he takes it.
Yeah, but you know, okay. Again, you had to assume he would.
Okay.
But so, he's carrying.
He's got the scroll and the girl. It's everything he needed.
Yeah, but
wait. In the mummy's hand, what was he going after? He wasn't going after the scroll. He's going after the tana leaves because that's what he needs.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what gets him when he's sucking it off the floor.
Yeah.
Poor guy. Hard to look really tough when I'm sucking it off the floor.
Yeah.
No, because Mehmet Bey has it in his hand. He's ordering him. And then now Gaharis has it. So the implication is he snapped him in half, took the scroll, grabbed the chick, and we're out the door.
Yeah. But again, as he's walking, he's carrying her down. He's got her in his arms.
He's got it in his hand. He's got to have it.
Because that's what they're. But if you watch the scene when he's carrying her to the swamp, you see both his hands, and you don't see unless he's got it in his pocket. I mean, that's
tucked under his arm. Yeah.
Yeah. But now the other thing is, early on in the movie, when you see Lee, and this is, it must have been one of the very first ones. Believe it or not, he has a he has nostril holes.
Yes.
In the mask. Okay. At the end, he does. In the beginning, he doesn't. Again, you know.
Yes, Dad, because he had to breathe.
Yes, I know. No, I realize that. But what I'm saying is this, when they first put him in the costume.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's got the eye. First of all, his eyes are recessed because of the wrappings, right? They're not in any way like the Karloff ones where they're almost glued out.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
But he has no nostril. It was obvious when I saw that. I said something's missing out of this. So I went back and I just backtracked back to the original scene with him as the mummy, and I said, yeah, he has no nostril holes. So they must have changed it because he couldn't breathe.
Right. Like 100%. Daddy.
Yeah. But I'm saying
poor guy's suffocating.
But the thing is, they wouldn't have made nostril holes when they were making him the mummy to begin with.
Again, willing to buy everything up to this point. But not that the poor guy could actually finish breathing.
No, but Jay, you know me when I'm doing these, reviews. I am watching it with a critical eye.
Yeah.
And because that is, you know, continuity. If you got a half glass full of beer and the next scene it's full and he's taking a big swig and the next scene it's full again, that to me is wrong because you're paying somebody as a continuitist and they just aren't following what they need to see.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing is though is that he needed to be able to breathe, so
yes.
we did the unthinkable of letting him actually have a breath. So anyway. So you can, you know, and again, when you're watching this, this movie will feel very, very familiar to you, because it is basically the setup for every other mummy movie you've seen, because it kind of takes the greatest hits of the other mummy movies besides them all together. Now, this is Kaharis, which is my favorite mummy, over Imhotep. Kaharis is always more action-packed. He's the guy who's willing to kill some people, whereas Imhotep is just like walking around with a fez on, and he's very wrinkly. But, you know, and then, again, notwithstanding the Stephen Sommers versions of all these guys, because that all, you know, then he's got a giant mouth and turned himself into sand and water and stuff, too. But this, as I said, is very, very British. And when you start watching this, and if you've never seen Hammer movies, you should go back and watch them, because they are very good, especially Horror Dracula, which to me is still the best Dracula movie ever made. And Curse of Frankenstein is a great Frankenstein movie, although I think Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, or I'm trying to remember which one. There's another one of the other Frankensteins, I think, is a better Frankenstein movie than Curse of Frankenstein. Curse of Frankenstein tells us the setup story really well. But I want to say it's Frankenstein. I think it might be Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. I'm trying to remember which one it was. But it's one of them where it's just like, I don't remember if it's the one where he's got the, there's so many other ones that are somewhere more interesting,
yeah,
you know, kind of thing. It's not the same story over and over again. The thing with Horror Dracula is Horror Dracula is just such a good telling of the Dracula tale. Yeah. And it streamlines the heck out of it.
Yeah, the thing is, as they get further and further on, some of the storylines get a little more ridiculous. What's the one where Frankenstein meets the outer space monsters?
No, that's nothing to do with Hammer, Dad.
I know, but
Frankenstein versus Frankenstein, you know, versus the space monster.
Space monster.
Yeah, that's not even
which is an octopus.
No. That Frankenstein and that's not Frankenstein. That's an astronaut who crashes back on Earth. That has nothing to do with Frankenstein at all. Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster is literally, it's an astronaut question. And it wasn't even called that originally. It was called something else. But I'm saying, there's no Frankenstein fighting a thing of that. Not an actual Frankenstein. Remember, Frankenstein as a name.
Maybe that's what they called. And I'm just saying that.
Yeah. You're thinking of Frankenstein Conquers the World, which is a Toho movie that they call him Frankenstein.
Right.
But he's not really Frankenstein, right. Yeah. But he kind of is. Luke can explain better of this.
Yes.
But I'm saying that's what you're thinking of.
Yeah.
And that's a Toho movie.
Yeah. No.
This is not British classic horror,
but
Dad.
They use the title. They use Frankenstein. So you almost, and the thing is, the Frankenstein is, it's a deformed, you know, person fighting the octopus. That's the scene I've seen.
Yeah. But okay. So the thing is,
let's forget that for
the terminology Frankenstein is used.
Yes.
When you can't use King Kong, many King Kong movies or King Kong ripoffs became Frankenstein became because Frankenstein's in the public domain and King Kong is copyrighted. Okay. It's a lot of stuff about that stuff. Like the Frankenstein is used to fill in. It's like calling any vampire movie Dracula. They're not all Dracula, but like what happened? Dracula became copyrighted, and or was copyrighted at the time, so they called things Nosferatu, which is not copyrighted, right, kind of thing. So, yeah. But Frankenstein and Conquers the World had nothing to do with that. Anyway, the whole thing is, so if you haven't seen this, it's available. It's part of a Blu-ray set, but there is, you can see it, you know, through Prime Video and stuff like that as well. It's, you know, I enjoy it. I think if you like mummy movies and you haven't seen this one, it seems you probably maybe missed out, but it is certain. I think you're going to get a hammer, you know, red paint splattered everywhere kind of movie. That's not this. This is not the later Draculas or even some of the Frankensteins and stuff like that, or even Curse of the Werewolf. But well worth your time. To me, I enjoyed it. You know, critically, you know, it got the normal kind of things Hammer movies got. You know, the British press kind of didn't like them, but everyone else knew they made money. And so, you know, like there's, you know, it's just different. It's really nicely lit movie. It's like the sets are good, everything like that. And, you know, it stands out from being very different than the Karloff from 32. And those are the two main one people think of. And to be honest, if you said to someone, a mummy, describe a mummy to me, you're going to talk about someone who's dragging their leg behind them, whatever. You're talking about hand, ghost, cursed, right, and, you know, a tomb. And this takes from that too, because Kahar drags his leg behind him after he's been shot and, you know, banged up a few times. So anyway. All right, folks. So that about wraps it up for our April episode. We'll be back in May for two of them. We have two in May, but our first one in May, we're going back to 1974, 50 years ago, for TCM, a.k.a. the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. All right, folks. So like we say around here, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc., are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?